Welcome to the latest episode of the Conferences for Women podcast, offering true stories and real-world advice from the sharpest, most successful women out there. I'm your host, Lisa Bennett, and today we're going to talk about how and why you should use the power of behavioral science to transform your working life. With us to discuss this powerful topic is economist and former McKinsey partner Caroline Webb, author of the enormously useful book, How to Have a Good Day. Caroline, welcome to the Conferences for Women podcast. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So, you know, being someone who seems to have an insatiable appetite for books with advice about how to be more effective, successful, even happy, I've definitely noticed there's no shortage of advice out there, but your work is different from that of many others in that you bring insights from behavioral economics, psychology, and neuroscience to the topic, offering a blend of the science and the practical. Can you tell us why is that?
Well, I wanted to be a scientist as long ago as I can remember when I was a little girl. I wanted to be an astrophysicist. All set on working for NASA and was doing a lot of physics and math and chemistry. And then because of the way that my class schedule worked out, I ended up taking a class in economics when I was 16. And it blew my mind that you could be structured and thoughtful and rigorous about human stuff. And that was really the point at which I rethought about what I wanted to do with my life. And I realized that I was fascinated in this question of how can we as human beings be at our best, whether we're thinking about individuals or teams or groups or companies, organizations, countries, and regions. And so I really became fascinated in that question. So the choice came quite early on, but I will say I spent about a decade working in public policy as a professional economist, and I really found that over time, the human side of the human science dropped off a little bit more than I wanted. And so then I made a big choice to go into organizational change consulting, but still keeping that focus on the rigor from the economics background. I did a bit of neuroscience and psychology training and just found that the evidence base was so helpful in the work that I was doing with clients to help them change their organizational culture, change themselves. So the evidence really just helps a lot, you know, when you're trying to do something new to kind of know why you're doing it, really powerful. So behavioral science just became such a strong part of my practice as an executive coach, as a management consultant.
I love that you wanted to go work for NASA initially and then focus on.
Yes, you know, and I still have a passing interest in physics, and I read a lot of science fiction, I have to say, you know. but I just, you know, my interest in science never went away. I became more and more interested in the human dimensions of the science of high performance and potential. So yeah, so that's how the book emerged.
Nice. And I was struck by a comment you made somewhere about how you noticed that smart people often want to know the why behind things.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I went to McKinsey, the consulting firm, and I was really clear that I wanted to do cultural change work, leadership development, you know, all the people stuff. And it just became clear that as I was working with often quite analytical, quite intellectual people who had, you know, risen through their career and, you know, by doing great work in their fields, they wanted the same level of rigor and evidence that they applied to their business plans. They wanted, in order to think about changing the way that their team operated or, you know, the way that they behaved as a leader, you know, if it was a business plan, then they would have had an Excel spreadsheet and they would have had, you know, models predicting what was going to happen and why. And, you know, when you take that same personality and you think about what it takes to change the way that you behave, of course, you know, it is helpful to understand what's the science behind this. And also, I think that the science really helps you understand that you're not alone. You're not the only one who has this funny, quirky thing that your brain does under pressure.
So, you know, to back up a little bit to look at why it's important that people
you know, or why it's helpful, I guess is a better way to say it, that we gain an understanding of behavioral science. I know you wrote a really interesting piece in Quartz last year about why every leader will need behavioral science 101 in the fourth industrial revolution. Thought maybe you could set the stage for that about why it's important, and then we can dive in a little bit more to what it is.
Yeah, well, you know, finally the robots are here. Although I have to say, in our household, you know, our Google Homes and our Alexas have been not particularly bringing the fourth industrial revolution into our lives. And just as often likely to say, "I'm sorry, I don't understand the question," when you ask what. But you know, the truth is, you know, all those studies that are out there are showing that there is already real impact in an enormous proportion of the jobs that exist. Most industries will have a significant proportion of jobs affected by automation and AI. And so, you know, we're at the point where it's a reality that anything that is predictable, any task that's predictable, any task that's sort of repeatable and routine is susceptible to being automated. And so then we think, my goodness, what does that leave us, human beings? We have to become ever more brilliant at playing to our human strengths, because we have to think about, you know, making the most of what we have. And if you think about human strengths, I mean, we all have our probably a list of what we think human beings are uniquely good at, but probably things like creativity and wisdom, the ability to make good choices when things aren't black and white and, you know, there's not an obvious way forward, or empathy and the ability to inspire people. So to understand where someone else is coming from and also set a vision that gets people feeling like it's, you know, life is worth living. Now, you know, maybe there will come a point where machines can do those things, but for the moment, human beings do still excel at those things: creativity, wisdom, empathy, and inspiration. And then you think, well, okay, we know from behavioral science that there are really predictable things that managers, that leaders, that we can all do to create environments that are rich in those things, that encourage those things to flourish. But if you think about the average person in the street, they don't know how their brain works. They don't know how the people's brain works. They don't know exactly what happens when someone's under pressure and why it is the fact that you're under pressure leads you so often to have your mind go blank, and what you can do about that so that you can stay wise under pressure. But these things are knowable. I mean, science is very clear on things that you can do that will help. So that's my feeling. I think that the average manager gets trained in strategy and business planning and so on. And I think it's time that the average manager also got some training in how the software in our heads works, not just you know, the machinery that's all around us. But
that makes a lot of sense. So let's jump into your amazing book, How to Have a Good Day. So two things jump out at me just from that title. One is a question about what do you mean by a good day? Because, you know, I guess I have thought a good day might mean one thing to me, you know, based on my preferences, and something else to someone else. And then there's also something about that title, How to Have a Good Day, that suggests that it's under our influence. And very often I think we think it's kind of luck if we've had a good day.
Yeah, it's so true. And, you know, honestly, sometimes it is luck. You know, there is luck. There is definitely luck in our lives. There's, you know, there is randomness. There are forces beyond our control. But I did become very interested in the question of how much we can control the way that we feel throughout and at the end of the day. And I mean, taking your first question first about what's a good day, I used to ask all my clients, and this ended up, you know, being something which I had maybe, well, several hundred data points on. I would ask them, what is a good day for you? What is a bad day? And what would make you have more good days? And it was a very simple set of questions, but it was really interesting over time, over different countries and regions of the world and different contexts and different ages. There was a really clear set of themes that emerge. I mean, what that actually looks like for each individual, of course, is a bit different, but it's typically about the fact that you feel like you're spending time on things that matter, and that you feel like you're knocking the ball out of the park. You feel good about what you're actually doing, whether it's got a social aspect or an intellectual aspect. You feel like people are listening to you and what you're saying lands and makes a difference. And then there's something about the end of the day, you feel good about the energy that you have. Even if you're tired, you feel like you could do it all again and ride through the ups and downs. And that came out again and again, that feeling of, okay, you know, this is the core of it. And I didn't call the book How to Have an Amazing, Awesome Day. Because, you know, I think that is so much down to luck a lot of the time. But I am very interested in what we can do within constraints, within the challenges that we all have. You know, what is there that, you know, we can do to make every day a little bit better? And systematically, that adds up to a good life.
Mm. And you certainly have no shortage of strategies in your book, and we'll get to some of those in a moment. But I know that a foundational piece of this is your explanation around the two brain system. And I love that you focus on that, because I've wanted to read that Daniel Kahneman book ever. So daunting.
Yeah. Now, my book is the practical complement to this.
So, yeah, if you could, you know, explain that in clear, simple terms.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, when you think about yourself and who you are, you're thinking about typically what I call the deliberate system. It's the part of the brain that does everything deliberately, that you're conscious of. So it's your part of the brain that's doing reasoning and self-control and forward thinking. But this part of the brain, the deliberate system, is obviously fabulously intelligent, but it is also limited. It can only take in a certain amount of information at any given time. It also gets tired really quickly. And you'll find, as you know, that it doesn't take much to overload as a result. And so what happens, and the reason why we don't freeze like an overloaded computer, you know, multiple times a day, is that we have an enormously powerful second system, which is autopilot. It's the automatic system. It's the bit of the brain which is taking care of everything that we do unconsciously, subconsciously. There are a gazillion different names for this. I call it deliberate system and automatic system, because it's the things we do automatically and the things we do deliberately, the other way around. And we have a wonderful interplay between the two, because that deliberate system is like a flaky professor, gets tired and overwhelmed very quickly, super smart, but a little fragile. And then the automatic system swoops in like a brilliant assistant and takes care of actually the majority of what we do. Mm-hmm. But it works very fast and sometimes makes mistakes and tends to go for easy answers rather than the complicated answers, which is really helpful when you're trying to just make a quick decision on what to have for lunch. It's not so good if you're trying to decide where you want to invest your company's big budget for next year. So the question is, how can you use your deliberate system without overloading it and treating it carefully and lovingly and letting it make the really difficult decisions while playing to the strengths of the automatic system? And, you know, so much of what it takes to be at your best is really, you know, figuring out how to do exactly those things.
So what's the answer?
Well, read the book. No, I think one really nice example of the interplay between the deliberate system and the automatic system is that the deliberate system can only perceive a certain amount of information at any given time. And, you know, you're surrounded all the time by trillions of pieces of data. You know, the sensation that you have in your big toe on your right foot right now is a piece of data. The way that the light is falling on whatever is in front of you, you know, is many other pieces of data. But your deliberate system can only process about 50 bits of data at any given time. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that the automatic system is almost, it is constantly filtering out the majority of what's around you. And sometimes it filters out the things that are irrelevant, which is helpful. And sometimes it filters out things that are relevant. And so the question is, how can you be more deliberate in making sure that you direct your scarce stock of conscious attention to the things that really matter? And it turns out that whatever is top of mind for you, whatever you say, okay, this is my aim, this is the attitude I want to take into this, these are the assumptions I want to have, will direct your brain to focus on things that are related to those, to the aim, attitude, and assumptions you're bringing. So, you know, that is one of the reasons it's so helpful to be very intentional before you go into any kind of conversation. So that's actually, sorry, just a timeout. That is a big topic, and I'm not sure I did a brilliant treatment of it. I'm very happy to have another go if you want.
Well, it was an enormous question.
Basically, yeah. I asked you, like, tell me about two systems.
60 seconds there. It would be great to dive in further, but and maybe even before that, just understanding that there are these two different ways in which our brains operate. You know, for those of us who maybe are not so great at science, you know, why is that really important to grasp?
It's really important to grasp the strengths and weaknesses of each of the two systems, of the deliberate system and the automatic system, because it's the way that your brain divides and conquers the job of getting life done. And if you understand what each system is good at, then you can be a bit more deliberate in creating the environment to really make the best use of your brain. So, for example, your deliberate system gets tired really quickly, more quickly even than perhaps you're aware. We can only process a certain amount of information at any given time consciously. We can only do one thing at a time consciously. And so when we take even the smallest of breaks and give that deliberate system a chance to reboot all of its intellectual skills, it comes back to a problem with fresh insight. I mean, you know that if you take a step away and you go for a walk and you come back and the incredibly difficult problem suddenly becomes something where you can see a way forward. That's not your imagination. That's you giving your deliberate system a break and a chance to recharge. And, you know, the more that we can know things like that about our deliberate system and our automatic system, the easier it is to be more deliberate about hitting the ball out of the park time and again.
So for the person who, you know, is a real layperson in this kind of understanding, it's not so much under the need to recognize, oh, now it's this part of my brain, or now it's that part of my brain, or now I need to rely on this or that part of my brain, but we have these different ways of operating, and one of them we have a bit more control over.
There you go. Absolutely. And the truth is, we are all using our deliberate system and our automatic system all the time at every given moment. You know, we are the living embodiment of the interplay between those two systems all the time. You know, our automatic system is keeping us alive. It's making us breathe right now. It's telling us how to speak, how to make sounds so that it comes out of our mouth. The deliberate system is helping me think about what to say next. No, seriously, I am thinking about it. So you know, the point is that, you know, it is the essence of a human being that we have these two systems. It is what enables us to get so much done and to be so brilliant. But only if we understand that our deliberate system needs rest, needs breaks, needs not to multitask, you know, really can do only one thing at a time, that, you know, performance really tanks if you ask it to do more than one thing at a time, and so on. And that, you know, under stress, there's much, much less activity in the deliberate system. So that's why we all become a little bit dumber and a little less nice under stress. Mm-hmm. You know, so the more that we can understand that, we don't have to use very technical language, but the more we can understand, actually, no, it really does help us optimize the way that we can think and the way that we feel if we don't overload our brain. You know, that's a good recipe for having a better day each day.
Yeah, so I'm really happy you brought that multitasking issue up. It's, you know, I know that there's been study after study that has really made it into the mainstream press on the disadvantages of multitasking and the, you know, argument that there is in fact no such thing as multitasking. I think, as you say, you're switching back and forth.
That's right.
yet we live in this environment where there seems to be such pressure and such temptation to do that, that I'm guessing most of us do it.
I think this is the intellectual battle of our age, is the question of where we put our attention and how do we recognize that we are sharper and smarter when we are not fragmenting and scattering our attention, when we are able to focus on one thing at a time, which is, you know, it's not to say that you don't want to mix things up and get a bit of variety in your life and in your days. And actually, you know, having a chance to do some social things and some cognitive things. And, you know, of course, it's great to have variety, but the point is not from second to second. You're really making your brain work super hard if you're switching your attention all the time, because as you say, you know, each of those tiny switches of attention from email to conference call to thing that's just in front of the window that looks suddenly very interesting to colleague that's walking past to, you know, this is exhausting to listen to. It's even more exhausting for your poor brain to do. And each of those tiny switches of attention takes a little bit of time and a little bit of energy. And that's what leads us to make a lot more errors when we are multitasking, between 2 and 4 times as many mistakes, depending on which study you look at. Also, we think we feel super busy when we're juggling a ton of things, but we're actually taking typically a serious chunk of time longer to get things done. I mean, the study that sticks in my mind is 30%, and studies are typically around that kind of zone. 30% longer to get things done. My God, no wonder we're all exhausted. So, you know, single tasking as much as possible, relearning how to do that does give you a big productivity boost. And that's a very, very lovely thing to feel at the end of the day. Yeah, actually, I spent time on the thing that mattered and I did make progress.
Which goes back to your good day, right?
There you go. Yeah.
So given the pressure that there is because of all the stimulation around us and, you know, cultural expectations about getting a million things done at the same time, how do we relearn that single tasking practically? You know, how have you done it? How would you recommend?
What I know doesn't work is just to say, right, I'm going to single task. It's very hard to relearn a habit because we're so patterned. It's something that we do automatically, and the automatic system of the brain is very powerful. And once you've got into the habit of having your phone constantly with you in your hand, pinging you, you know, that's become quite deeply rooted in our sense of what it means to be connected to the world. So that is not a trivial thing to change. And anyone who has struggled with the, oh, I'm going to go offline now, please don't feel bad. It really is actually genuinely quite difficult, but I would encourage people to always start small. You know, I think sometimes when people are experimenting with single tasking and they're trying to go offline more, they say, oh, I'm going to go offline for 90 minutes. But if that's not where you're starting from, I'd be kinder to yourself. I'd say, okay, get a timer, preferably not on your phone. I've actually got really low-tech timers on my desk. And set it for 5 minutes and just notice how it feels to be fully present with whatever task you're doing. And if you're anything like me, when I started out with this, you know, you find yourself starting to twitch a little bit. Actually, you know, closing down notifications, having a visual cue on your desk, a timer, telling other people that you're doing it, that's very helpful too, because we're very social creatures. And if we've made a commitment to other people that's something we're experimenting with to do less multitasking, you know, that's actually quite a powerful incentive as well. And I have to say that sometimes I do just get some distance. I get some distance from the devices. I walk away. I go and sit somewhere else so that I can focus perhaps with a piece of paper and a pen. So all of which to say, this is something which I don't just magically do. I really work very hard on that.
Well, you did very well turn off all your devices before we started.
That is true. I'm fiendish in turning off notifications. Whenever I update my phone or my computer, I have to go through all the process again of switching off every notification. And, you know, it's really worth it. You do then engage more on your own terms. I'm not saying that you don't still need to work at it, but it's really worth it.
And I heard you refer to using tech to fight tech.
Yeah.
Which seems apropos here. would be great if you share some of those specific tools that you use.
So I think the reason that I wrote a book or was able to write a book was because of the existence of an app, which, to be clear, I have no vested interest in, but an app that I use called Stay Focused, which allowed me to block very precisely my access to certain websites. Say Twitter and Facebook, for example, and it allowed me to say, you know what, I'm going to give myself 10 minutes of treat time, social connection between the hours of, you know, in my case, it was 10 a.m. and 8 p.m. because I'm a night owl. So, you know, I tend to work a bit later. And yeah, so, you know, that allowed me to be quite precise in saying, I can have unlimited access outside those hours, but during those book writing hours, this is not something which I'm going to allow myself to do. Honestly, you know, there are a ton of these out there now. And it's helpful because it allows you to pre-commit to what you think and say you really, really want to do. And then it makes it extremely difficult for you to make the dumb automatic decision, which is, I'm a little bit bored right now, or I'm finding this problem a little bit hard, and therefore I would like to see a cat video, please. And
I have never done that. What do you mean?
No, really. You know, and there are times in your life when that is fine, but you know, if you're really trying to get something done, you're trying to do deep thinking, at least once a day, I would say, see whether you can go offline and use one of these apps to help you do it.
You know, I love that you use it, because I think when I think about that kind of thing, I think it should be a matter of willpower that I can just decide not to do it.
Yeah, it turns out one of the biggest findings, I would say, from behavioral science in the last decade is that willpower is a terrible thing to rely on. It's not just you. It's a really increasingly robust finding that actually you're much better off trying to change the environment around you than trying to change yourself directly. So that's what I meant by sort of, okay, I've got a timer, I switch off notifications, I've got an app that blocks access through my browser, and you know, you change the environment. And I mentioned telling people that this was something you're experimenting with, that changes the social environment as well. I mean, when you have a conversation with your team, you know, your colleagues about this, it becomes a lot easier to sustain your commitment to try and stay focused and bring your attention to the task at hand if you know that it's something that your team is talking about doing more and more effectively.
Right. And also in the context that you set out at the beginning about the, you know, the automatic and the deliberate parts of our brain, sort of seeing it through that lens, one can feel less bad about it. Yeah. Not being able to do it on our own, right? It's just the way.
Absolutely. I love hearing from teams that have taken this evidence and had an open conversation with each other about what the norms are that they want to adopt. And you know, a lot of this does come down to also having a good open conversation with your boss about, okay, well, you know, I'm going to go offline to do some deep thinking, or to really nail this report, or whatever language you want to use. But starting to be clear in saying, okay, I'm going to step away to do this work really well. If you frame it in terms of performance, then you're going to have a different conversation with your colleagues and the people you work for.
Right. We are very sadly just about out of time.
So my goodness.
I know.
I feel like we've just started.
Exactly. We have your 100 strategies to touch on. Mm-hmm. Did want to wrap up with one thing. I know that you say you focus on every day is the setting of intentions. So it seems like that might be a nice place to wrap up with, you know, why you do that, how you do that, and what impact that's had.
Well, we all think that we have an objective grip on reality around us, but actually we only ever get to perceive a part of reality. We experience a very small amount of what's around us at any given time because our deliberate system can only process a certain amount of information at any given time. Most of the time, we're filtering out a good deal of what's around us. And what we get to perceive consciously is driven by what is already top of mind for us. So if we go into a situation and we are in a good mood, studies have shown that we are more likely to notice the things that confirm that we are right to think that the world is a good place. If we go into a conversation expecting someone to be a jerk, confirmation bias means that we will see things that confirm that that person is a jerk. Now, I'm not saying that they're not a jerk, but if you can be more deliberate about perhaps setting a broader, more collaborative intention, like my intention is not to prove that this person is a jerk, but actually to acknowledge that he might be a bit difficult, but to look for ways that we can find a point of collaboration, your brain will make sure that you see things that match your intention. And that sounds a bit woo-woo, but actually the science on this is very robust, very deep. It's the science of selective attention. And it's one of the most powerful ways that we can reset the way that a meeting is going, reset the way that a day is going, to say, what is it that I most want to see in the next 5 minutes? Your brain will filter out things that are not related to that intention, and it will filter in things that are related to that intention. It's a nice way of cheering yourself up to say, I want to see three delightful things in the next 5 minutes. However much I'm doing it through gritted teeth.
It's wonderful. Well, wow, we could talk forever. If you had the time, I would love that, but cannot recommend your book highly enough. It's quite amazing work.
And thank you
for making this time, and also for being willing to participate in a Facebook Live.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure. I've had such a blast speaking at all the women's conferences, all four of them. You know, it's been a really treasured experience. And so to be able to connect with your wider community in this, you know, this different way remotely is a real treat. So thank you for asking me.
Fabulous. It was a joy. Thanks so much. And have a good day.
Always.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please subscribe right now so you don't miss future conversations like this one, with more of the most popular speakers from the Conferences for Women.